Hi, this is Attorney Todd Hollis, and welcome to another episode of Civil Action. There's a whole lot going on in the world today. The inauguration of President Joe Biden, the Senate races in Georgia, and all of the craziness that's happening at the Capitol. But if you don't pay attention, you're going to miss a very important race that's occurring right here in Allegheny County to determine who sits on our Court of Common Pleas for judge. Well, I'm proud to introduce to you that I have three of the hottest candidates here right now to introduce themselves and their platforms to you. I have Attorney Mark Daffner, the Honorable Bruce Beamer, and Attorney Joseph Murphy. Gentlemen, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
Thanks, Todd.
All right. So before we get, too deep into the show, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules. You know, I know that your respective candidacies are just beginning. And I'd like to give you guys an opportunity to kind of introduce yourself to your constituents and to explain, briefly your legal background. So I see you, Mark, in the top of my screen. So why don't you go first, and then we'll go to Attorney Murphy, and then we'll follow up with you, Judge Beamer. Does that work?
Sure. My name is Mark Daffner. I'm 52 years old. I'm married. I have three kids. I live in the South Hills. And I've been practicing law since 1993. My concentrations are in criminal law, family law, and commercial litigation. What I focus on is helping people, regular people getting through the system, trying to make a positive change. And I've always been a firm believer that in order to be a good trial judge, you have to be a trial lawyer. You can't just be a real estate guy and decide to be a trial lawyer because there's a judicial election. And that's what I do. I try cases. I've helped people in thousands of legal matters. And if my math is correct, I have been in 33 of our 67 Pennsylvania counties. I am also what's called a super lawyer. That is peer review, meaning other lawyers select you for that honor. That's 5%, top 5% in the state of Pennsylvania. And I'm a top 100 national trial lawyer. I like to think I know my way around the courtroom and I know how to get things done. Outside the law, I'm active in a variety of community activities. I coach hockey. I'm a former hockey player myself. So now you've learned one of those. Tell us a fun fact about you, about me. You now know that. My oldest daughter plays. I sponsor sports teams. I contribute a lot to local charities like the Mary Lemieux Foundation, Cystic Fibrosis, Animal Friends, and so on. And, my basic position is for almost 30 years, I've been defending our rights in courts throughout Pennsylvania. And I'd like to continue doing that and protecting our rights as a judge of the Court of Common Pleas. Thanks.
All right. All right. Thank you, Mark. Attorney Murphy.
Thank you for that, Todd. That was actually very good, Mark. Nice intro. My name is Joseph Patrick Murphy. I'm 51 years old. Got a year on Mark there. I've been practicing law since 1998. My career has primarily focused on consumer protection and immigration-related matters. I've handled probably this firm and through the other lawyers that work with me, maybe 10,000 credit card defense cases. Consumer defense was a big part of my practice. I'm a husband and a father. I've got two sons. We live in the North Hills. I think a lot of what motivates my interest in being on the bench is judicial temperament. I've been in front of good judges and bad judges, just like everybody else. And I think with the best judges, people can leave court knowing that their rights were respected, that they were respected, and that the decision that was made, even if it disfavored them, was a result of a rational, fair, and reasonable process. Judges too often just bark out orders or decisions. They don't explain to people why. And in many cases, 5-10 extra seconds taken explaining something can make a lot of difference in the emotion in the courtroom and the takeaway that people have at the end of the day. So we talk about judicial temperament. Obviously, we've seen recently a judge that was lacking in temperament and has left the bench. And that's been going on. I mean, here in Western Pennsylvania, we've had people leave with substance abuse problems. We've had people take it away in handcuffs. So this is something that I take very seriously. Being a judge is a public servant. It's not just something you do for fun. So that's my take on why I want to be a judge and what I want to bring to the courtroom.
Thank you. Thank you. Judge Beamer.
Thank you, Todd. My name is Bruce Beamer. I am currently a judge in the Allegheny County Court of Common Pleas. I was nominated for the position by Governor Wolf in December of 2019 and was unanimously confirmed by the Pennsylvania Senate a few weeks after that. I was assigned directly to the criminal division, which is actually quite unusual. Todd, you probably know that almost all judges start in the family division, whether they're elected or appointed. There were a number of the judges, including our president and administrative judge of the division, who were supportive of the idea of my going directly to the criminal division. And I'd like to think that speaks to my background and my credentials in that area. I also live in the North Hills with my wife and two kids who are 13 and 11. And I believe I do have a really strong background. I think what Mark said earlier is very true. I've tried over 100 jury trials during my career, both as a prosecutor and as a criminal defense attorney and as a plaintiff civil attorney representing folks in environmental contamination cases. So I had a lengthy career as a trial lawyer. And then over the last 5 or 6 years, I had been tasked with some of the highest levels of administration in our state government. I served as the first deputy attorney general, which is the number two person in that office for a number of years, and also ran the criminal division in that office. And then when then Attorney General Kathleen Kane got herself in some trouble and had to resign following criminal convictions, the governor tasked me to finish out her term as attorney general. And again, that was the first time I had been unanimously confirmed by the state Senate for a very important position. For the 3 years after that, I served in Governor Wolf's cabinet as the inspector general of Pennsylvania, where my responsibility was to help root out waste, fraud, and abuse in our executive branch agencies and state government. So I have a history of being involved in some of our largest executive branch agencies who are tasked with reforming and making sure government works for everybody. I like to think I bring those values to the bench, which are consistent with really, really important goals for everyone, which is equality, fairness, and justice for everyone, regardless of who you look like, or what you look like, who you love, who you pray to. You should get equal fair treatment in our courts under the law. And I believe I've been doing that for the last year and have a reputation for doing that. Joe talked about temperament and reputation on the bench. I think I have that in terms of the folks that come in front of me, whether they are litigants or advocates. I believe it's one of the reasons I've been highly recommended by the Allegheny County Bar Association to retain my judicial position. And I hope that I'm able to convince folks that's the right call. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, Todd, and look forward to a discussion on what's important to everybody.
Well, you know, I'm honored that, you know, during the course of my 27 years, you know, I've practiced with each and every one of you guys, you know, so I certainly have a personal perspective, and I know all of you to be very skilled trial lawyers. So yeah, I certainly expect much success in your respective campaigns. I think social media is very important. It's important because it allows your potential constituents to engage with you, to get an opportunity to know you, so that when they go to their respective polls, you know, they can reflect back on some of these conversations, and they can say, you know what, you know, I really see a lot of my views, a lot of the things that I respect in Judge Beamer, or I see it in Attorney Murphy, or I see it in Mark Daffner. You know, those are the things that I think our viewers need, you know, because it allows them to be informed, it allows them to be engaged, and it allows them to make what I would be considered, you know, well-informed decisions. So with that being said, I want to let you know something. We got an interesting game right here, and it's called what are your positions relative to your viewers poll. I'm going to ask each and every one of you to choose a number 1 through 24, and I'm going to read that viewer's poll to you, and I like your position on it. And then if the other two members have an opinion on it, then I'm going to give you an opportunity to obviously to chime in. You, sound right to you guys?
Sure.
All right, cool. All right, Mark, we're going to start with you. Choose a number between 1 and 24.
Okay, I'm going to go with my old hockey number of 17.
17, lucky number 17. All right. 17 comes from Kathleen Papeo. She says, private prisons end them and stop cops from playing judge and jury by shooting black men, women, and children in the back and in their sleep. That's a hard one, brother. What's your position?
I think those are very good points. I'm not sure that that's something that the courts per se address on a daily basis. For example, we have no control over what a particular municipality or county does with their prison. I think we can get involved. I think being on the bench gives you a larger voice to, for example, go to the jail oversight committee and weigh in on these issues. But, you know, a judge can't say, hey, you know what? I think this private prison sucks. So we got to make the county build a new one. And, you know, we're not allowed to do things like that when we are hearing cases as trial judges. With regard to her other concern, you know, I think she sort of phrases it, stop cops from shooting people. I mean, that has been an issue that we have seen, not just in the last year that it's really come to light, but you know, there have been instances, you know, for as long as I've been in practice, as long as any of us have been in practice, of police abuse. There are also very good police officers. And, you know, I think if there's a stop loss, it is to make sure that when officers behave in that manner, that they are, in fact, brought and held to account for that behavior, that they're not just given a pass. I think that's where the courts can weigh in on that particular issue. You know, again, none of us here are going to sit on the Office of Municipal Investigations. You know, we don't go out in the field. We don't investigate that kind of stuff. But, you know, for the very few officers that do behave in a manner like that, I think if they are, you know, essentially put on notice that that's not going to be tolerated by the courts, that goes a long way toward addressing that problem.
And that hasn't happened. You know, I mean, just, you know, being honest, I mean, I agree that there are very good police officers, but, you know, during the course of the 27 years that I've been practicing, I don't recall a whole lot of cases where there's been what I would consider to be clear cases of police brutality. And I've seen police officers, you know, get arrested or even be charged civilly. So, you know, not to say that, you know, you're wrong. Or she's right, but I think that that's a common thread, you know, amongst a lot of people who are watching our judicial systems. Like, you know, what point does all of this end? You know, what can we do to make police officers feel that there has to be consequences, you know, to their actions? So, I think your response is obviously right on point. I understand it from a judicial perspective, but I just wanted, you know, I just wanted to add in that kind of layperson's understanding of how they see these things, and why they continue to happen. All right.
If I could just add one more.
Absolutely.
Think of that mix, as you pointed out, you know, a lot of times these officers aren't being prosecuted or they're being given a pass. And, you know, for the courts to get involved and for officers to be held accountable in a strange way sort of protects the officers. As you may know, a few years ago, I had a case that turned out to be the first case in U.S. history. And I think probably to date, the only case in U.S. history where self-defense was successfully used in a case involving the murder of a police officer. You know, I don't want to tear this officer up. You know, it's regrettable that this officer was was killed. And we didn't tear him up in trial either, but he had a history of discipline and everybody was taking a pass. Nobody ever corrected that problem. And it ended up with this gentleman charging into my client's front yard, pitch black, not identifying himself and just opening fire on my client, who was actually standing next to his car 45 minutes after a call for alleged domestic violence. And after the victim of that call had told 911 that, oh, you know what, he's leaving now. So, you know, if they're given a pass time and time again, eventually they may end up getting killed by somebody. So, you know, the disciplinary process, and I served as chair of the Civil Service Commission for a 6-year term also. And we dealt with termination, discipline, hiring, things like that. I mean, you know, that has to be taken seriously because it can have consequences not only on society, but on the officers themselves.
Sure, sure. Thank you, Mark. Judge Beamer or Attorney Murphy, do either one of you want to add to this?
I would say from my perspective, it's difficult, obviously, to opine on any specific factual situation, but accountability has to be the key here. And accountability includes accountability for all sides in a system. And for too long and too often, there's been a sense that there has been a lack of accountability in certain instances that have involved police officer engagements. And I think any police officer who truly believes in the rule of law, and the part of that includes equality and fairness for everybody across the system. Any police officer or law enforcement officer who truly believes that should want accountability in all situations. And I think that as a society, we need to move to a feeling of, you know, when you take a very difficult job, and being a police officer is a very, very difficult job. They put their lives on the line every day, but with that also comes great power and responsibility. And police agencies and individual police officers have to want and demand accountability along with society at large. And that's really a critical thing that has to move the dynamic away from, oh, something bad has happened to a police officer. How do we protect them? How do we get, they, in law enforcement, credibility comes with demanding accountability of your own. And that's a critical thing that I think has to be always thought of. It's difficult to talk about any individual or specific instance. I mean, we've seen things, particularly last summer, that I don't think any of us could ever countenance. And it has rightfully led to justifiable outrage about certain issues that have to be brought to the forefront. And I think it's a great thing. Mark said it well as well, Todd, which is judges have a role to play, but it is a limited, carved out role. Much sure. of what, where the change has to occur is from legislative and other governmental action that starts to shape things in a way that creates a balanced and fair playing field for everybody in the system.
I agree. Great points. Great points. Attorney Murphy?
Well, I was just going to say fairness is important. This is what the whole, I mean, the court system is not a business, but if you were to think of it like a business, its only product is fairness. To the extent that people think they're going to get that, they'll use the court system. Even not going to get it, they'll resort to their own devices. It's a terrible situation. You have to be able to produce the product that these people came for.
Awesome. I need you to choose a number 1 through 24.
I'll take 5.
You'll take 5. I like 5. Okay. Sandra Cole says racism. That's a toughie. What are your thoughts?
It really isn't. Racism. I mean, there's so many things there, but it relates, at least in the court system, again, back to my point about fairness. You cannot pick and choose. Judges are being paid to judge people fairly under the law. A judge who would allow these kind of extraneous issues into the decision-making process, it's stealing. They're being paid money. They're promising to do fair judging under the law. And I can't imagine, although I know it happens, it's just foreign to me that you would actually have a different system of justice for people in one race or skin color or religion or any of those things. It's nonsensical. It's not so related to the business of judging.
Let me ask you this, Joe. So,
sure.
I was in the criminal division for a significant part of my career. And I know that when I had various jury trials, representing, many black defendants, when we stepped into the jury pool room, very often there was maybe one or two, maybe three, black potential juror candidates, amongst 100 and some odd people. That can be very disheartening. I mean, I know that you don't necessarily control that, as a judge, but, obviously.
Well, you could certainly.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you've got a prosecutor systematically trying to exclude any minority and you can detect that as a judge, you can, sanction that appropriately. But when you're talking about the underrepresentation of one group or another in the jury pool at large, is that a failure to register to vote? Because aren't they drawn from voter registration? So a voter registration drive could do that. I mean, there could be a look.
Why don't you just go ahead and restate what you initially just said about...
Well, you had brought up the subject of perhaps jury pools that didn't accurately reflect the racial balance of our community. Obviously, if you've got a prosecutor or defense attorney that is systematically making efforts to strike minorities just because they're members of a minority group, the judges, that can be the subject of an appropriate sanction by the court, including various motions that the party aggrieved would file. But you brought up the subject of what if the pool itself, right? You go and there's just not enough of them. I think that there'd be opportunities for people to file motions to require that these jury pools be made more reflective of the overall community's balance. I think that could be done. I don't know what the limits on that are.
Uh-huh. Okay.
To the extent that that results in a perception of unfairness, you go back to my earlier point. And I'm not talking about a fake fairness, but what I'm talking about is the courts have to be able to deliver that product. People have to have confidence that the courts are going to give them a fair shake. If the court can't give people that confidence, they're going to resort to their own devices and you're going to have civil disorder. We saw it all last summer all over the country.
I think fundamentally, African Americans do not have a lot of confidence in our court system. And I think largely it has to do with our underrepresentation, either in our jury pools or even, African-American judges who are sitting on the bench who might be able to understand common cultural issues. But I understand your point, and I think it's right on point. I totally agree with it.
You have an option. I mean, the political process can take care of this by, within constitutional limits, enacting different jury selection procedures and criteria.
Sure.
If you're going to do like a motor voter, that'll get more people into the voter registration pool and get more people into the jury pool. You could have even voter registration drives if that's where the jury pool is being pulled from. You could also say we're going to pull the jury pool from a different set of records. I don't know what that would be, but again, that's a matter for legislatures. The judges
right.
would then decide on whether it had been done in accord with the law. So if the legislatures did that in a way that maybe didn't fix the problem, maybe made it worse, whether that was intentional or accidental, aggrieved parties could file lawsuits to stop that. Civil rights lawyers like yourself and judges would rule on those motions in accord with our community values and the law.
Great points. Mr. Daffner, Judge Beamer, either one of you want to weigh in?
I mean, I can weigh in from the perspective of, and you make a great point, Todd, about the jury pool. And my position as a judge is there's one of the ways a judge can address an issue like this, particularly in the criminal division, where the perception of fairness and equality is central to the viewed integrity of the system as a judge. If someone's being asked as a criminal defendant and their counsel to select a jury from a pool that does not reflect the diversity that is Allegheny County, because it's supposed to be a cross section of Allegheny County. If it does Sure. not reflect that diversity and there's not an attempt, doesn't mean who is ultimately going to end up on the jury, but there's not at least a diverse jury pool to pick from. There's nothing to stop a judge from saying this pool is not adequate and does not reflect the makeup, and we're going to go to another pool of jurors, or we're going to do it another way, because jury selection is of critical importance to both sides. So if someone
Absolutely.
Paid attention to the court in my courtroom, I would give serious consideration to whether or not it would make sense to ask both sides to move forward with jury selection if we had a jury pool that just did not make up was reflective of Allegheny County at large. Now, the other question, which is the general idea of racism, you know, explicit bias is something that is pernicious and that we see on a unfortunately all too regular basis. But it's actually in many instances, that's the kind of thing that can be easy to identify. Implicit bias is a little bit more difficult, and it's something that requires people to engage in self-reflection. How do I, as a person from how I look like and where I grew up, am I allowing implicit bias to come in and form or inform any of my decision making? We actually, the Pennsylvania judiciary is had a number of different courses on the ideas surrounding implicit bias and trying to do certain things to remove that to the extent possible from the courtroom. And I think it's very important for anybody who's on the bench to be mindful of the idea of implicit bias, not only in their own decision making, but also how it might affect individuals in witness identification, how it might inform the way a police officer acts or behaves. Because if you're not willing to do that and look at things from all sides and from all perspectives and with an empathetic eye and an empathetic ear, you're not really doing your job as a judge. And I think that's a critical area that all of us who end up on the bench have to constantly work at to try and get better and try to understand everyone who comes in front of us, regardless of how they may look.
Absolutely. Great points. Great points. Mark?
I think Judge Beamer has said it best in terms of implicit bias. You know, we're talking about jury selection, and there's sort of two elements of that. One is the jury pool. And I think the courts can get involved to some extent, as Judge Beamer said, and make sure that, you know, at least, you know, with the pool of people you have to work with, that it really does at least approximate the party's peers in the community.
Right.
The other end of that, and I think Joe touched on that, is, you know, what do you do about a prosecutor who is going to work to exclude African Americans from a jury? And it's not something that you just apply sanctions. I mean, it's actually a U.S. Supreme Court case, Batson versus Kentucky, that was decided, I believe, in 1986. Don't quote me on that. I'm getting old and senile here.
You're right, Mark. So that is, you got it, 1986.
That is absolutely illegal for the prosecution to systemically exclude African Americans using peremptory challenges. That doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. In my career, I have had to make Batson challenges. I've had to go in front of judges, typically not in this county, but I practice statewide, and say, hey, listen, you know, we had, you know, 8 African-Americans on the jury, and so far the prosecution has used, you know, 5 of their peremptories, and they've only excluded Black people. You know, of course, yeah. We'll give you know, they will come very close to yelling at the other side for that. And, you know, I mean, granted, you know, we also have to factor in the human element in terms of jury selection. I have had juries of complete hillbillies out in counties in the middle of the state acquit black defendants. You know, similarly, I've had juries where I've had four or five African-Americans on the jury find somebody guilty. You know, a lot will boil down to how the case itself is presented, you know, but that's just one element. I think that the question or the question that your Facebook person said was simply racism. That's one element where racism can be addressed. I think Judge Beamer went over the implicit bias. The other is sentencing, you know, and I don't know if we're going to talk about sentencing disparity yet, or if you have that down the road, if you are, then I'll stop my comments.
No, please continue. Right. That's a great point.
You know, because there, you know, there's not only is it an intra-jurisdictional and an inter-jurisdictional matter when you're talking about sentencing disparity, intra being, you know, within the same jurisdiction or the same county, you know, are there great wide disparities? And you'll expect some of that from the way different judges view different crimes. There's almost always inter-jurisdictional disparity because, you know, for example, here in Allegheny County, you're likely going to get a lesser sentence on a drug possession case than you will out in Clarion, where that is the worst crime they've ever seen.
Sure.
You know, and I mean, in terms of addressing that, a lot of that is not up to the courts. A lot of that is up to the legislature. I represent an individual in one of the first cases that held the President Obama's Fair Sentencing Act could be applied retroactively. And as you'll recall, that act sought to cure the disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine in terms of federal sentencing. And that was a 100-to-1 ratio back before that act, you know, and in our case, it actually saved my client 10 years of his life, you know, so it's disparities like that that are not just, you know, implicit bias or unique to the individual judge or even the individual jurisdiction, but also our legislature needs to get involved at some point and address these, you know, these statutes, sentencing statutes that provide for.
Well, Mark, I don't want to cut you. I want to stay on this point because there was a judge here in Allegheny County that at one point felt as if prosecutors were giving better plea deals to a certain class of people as opposed to the African American class. And he took some heat over that. But do you feel as if he had a valid point?
I think from his perspective, he had a valid point. I mean, you know, one of the things we need to be careful of is even if we're judges, not being too quick to judge. You know, if you've seen 10,000 defendants in front of you, half black, half white, and the black kids are always getting deals that make them go to jail, and the white kids are always getting a slap on the wrist, then you have a valid point. If you have two or three different cases, I mean, you really don't know what's gone into the prosecutor's decision. And that's not to say that that's not a valid point. To say that's a point that needs to be very carefully made and should not be, in my opinion, shouldn't be made off the cuff from the bench. I mean, if you perceive that, I think you have an obligation as a judge to do more, check into this background. Is this really going on, or are you just perceiving it for some reason? So, you know, I think he may have had a valid point. I don't know what went into that decision because I'm not looking through the eyes of that particular judge.
I understand, and I apologize for my off the cuff question. I mean, it was something that was on my mind, and I wanted your perspective on it. Okay, great, Judge Beamer. I need a number 1 through 24, sir. Did you say 10? 7. Okay, great. Christine Murphy Jukowitz says. Mental and emotional support for all, training police how to approach and help rather than shoot anyone in a debilitating state. So I think what she's saying is, is that when a police officer arrives to a particular scene, instead of, you know, responding with a bunch of excessive force, that they actually use tools that address that particular person's potential issues. So if somebody is a mental health, you know, patient and they're upset and they're screaming, as opposed to just exerting force upon that person, maybe bringing in, you know, a counselor or someone else to assist that person with their direct issues.
Yeah, I think, and that's been a topic of national conversation, right?
So okay.
That's the idea of how when there are police calls made and the police respond to a situation, how can they be in the best position to A, be trained to address these issues, and B, that there be mental health or other social support service individuals available to assist them so that situations don't have to escalate? And sure. How can they work on de-escalation as the first movement, as opposed to allowing things to escalate? And that's obviously a very difficult situation. Every situation obviously is dependent upon what occurs, the facts. How does somebody have a weapon? How agitated are they? Are they inside their own house? Is it outside? Are there other? I mean, there's so many variables that come into play in these situations. But the bottom line is, for decades, police were trained in a certain way to deal with to be responsive to threats. And how sure. do they deal with threats? The real question of how to move this forward and to avoid a lot of the tragedy that we see in communities repeatedly is how can they be trained to de-escalate situations and to have the sorts of support in difficult situations to allow there to be an alternative other than using force, and in some cases, unfortunately, deadly force. And that's a critical area that I think particularly larger police departments need to have a focus on. Focus right. on training their officers have to be trained how to deal with it, and they have to have independent external resources available to them so that they have other professionals that are specialized in this area that can be available to help them in real time. And that's how I think you can keep, when somebody's having a mental health crisis, that's a way you can keep them safe and get them the help that they need so that we don't have tragedy.
Great points. And, you know, I know that you were a prosecutor for, I mean, a number of years, and a very good one. But one thing that I enjoyed about you is that you always seem to take a very common sense approach, you know, to your individual cases. And I think that is a very important point, you know, with respect to, I think Joe said judicial temperament. So, great points. Does anybody else want to add on to what the judge has already stated?
Well, you know, my thought beyond just the criminal justice reform is the effect that the civil system can have on this, increasing the cost of this sort of mistake, or maybe not mistake, but misconduct. You know, those people, those police departments, municipalities, people can be held legally liable for money, and that will increase the cost so high that they'll have to change the procedures because they won't be able to afford to continue this nonsense. That's just another approach to it. I think you've done some of that work, and you know I have too. There's many different ways that the legal system has of dealing with different structural problems. That's one of them. It's another one that could be looked at.
You mean as a means of deterrence?
As a means of deterrence and or increasing the cost of this nonsense to the individual police departments, governments, and even individual police officers, to the point where they will stop doing it, or the procedures and training will be reformed to such degree because they have to. They wouldn't be able to afford it. That's the point, is just to increase the cost of this, both as a deterrent and as a way to really just get it to the point where it's impossibly expensive, because it's certainly impossibly expensive for the people that this misconduct is directed at. I mean, some of them are being killed. So I don't see why that you can't increase the money damages. Money is no substitute for life or even getting beat up in many cases. It's the wrong kind of solution. But on a structural or society-wide level, giant money damage awards that are being liberally given is a clear indication that society at large has decided they don't want this conduct, will severely punish it, and that it will be expensive. And I think just the general need to manage a budget will cause a migration away from behavior that they can't afford.
Okay.
Thought about the civil rule in that.
Great point. Attorney Daffner.
Right. I think I agree with the civil end, too, in terms of cost as a deterrent. But, you know, and first, actually, let me echo your sentiments, Todd, about Bruce. Bruce and I had many cases together, and you know, we're both what I would call nuts and bolts lawyers. We get to the bottom line and we're reasonable. And mm-hmm. I don't think we've ever actually had to have a trial because we worked everything out. But, you know, in terms of the inquiry here, I think it is a, you know, sort of a double or even a triple headed approach. I mean, first on the end of law enforcement, there needs to be more training in terms of threat assessment. Like Judge Beamer said, you know, for years and years and years, really forever, they've been trained to respond to threats. And a lot of times that is translated into viewing almost anything as a threat. You know, somebody just opens their car door a crack and all of a sudden weapons are drawn.
Sure.
You know, I think there has to be more, you know, and we dealt with training when I was on the Civil Service Commission too. And I've always expressed these views. There has to be a more realistic, element to the training. What is actually a threat? What is somebody in crisis? You know, nobody is going to tell an officer, you know, suppose there's somebody that's broken into a house and they're raping somebody. Nobody is going to tell the cops, oh, don't go in, call a social worker. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you have somebody that is clearly, you know, and you can determine they are having a mental health crisis, that does not mean that you have to necessarily tase them. In some cases, shoot them. Or grab them and run them down to the county jail. You know, there has to be a mechanism of training that addresses that. So that's, you know, I think that goes a long way. It's both, you know, training in the perception of what is the threat and the training what to do about it. And there do need to be more resources. From the ends of the courts, we have tried in our court system to address these faults when they get there. They're obviously there long after the fact, long after that interaction with the authorities.
Right.
We have things like mental health court. We have expanded counseling. Judges are more willing at this point to look at cases reasonably, like, hey, you know, so this guy did this, but you look into it and you say, well, why is this? Is this because this is a bad person and they've just been a thief their whole life or a scumbag? Or is this because they really need help? And to assess that during sentencing and say, hey, listen, you know, I could put you in jail for 2 years, but instead, you know, we're going to put you on probation and make a condition of, you know, inpatient counseling or so on. So I think,
right.
You know, the court needs to be willing. And I think our courts in Allegheny are willing to embrace that and have done a good job toward it. But there's always more that can be done.
So. I agree. You know, gentlemen, this is such an amazing opportunity. It's an opportunity for me to listen to each one of you as a prospective voter and to really hear what your thoughts are on important issues that we deal with every day. I can hear, you know, the level of experience that you guys have had in various sections of our legal system. I can hear your empathy, you know, as it respects to your daily walk of life. And your approaches to these things, you know, are the primary things that our constituents, you know, will be able to use when they walk into that voting booth and they're about to pull a lever. You know, our younger voters are much more concerned about individual candidates than they are about a political party. You know, in my youth, you know, if you were Democratic, you voted all Democratic. Or if you were Republican, you voted all Republican, because that's the way I was taught. But now, you know, they're like, no, you don't get a pass just because you belong to a particular party. Like, I need to know who, you know, who is Mark Daffner? Who's Joseph Murphy? Who's Bruce Beamer? I need to know that they share some common interest with me. You know, they may not always agree with me, but they share some common interest with me. And I believe that when they're elected, they're going to follow, you know, their respective task and take it seriously. So the question that I have for each one of you is, why should these potential constituents vote for you? And I know I started with you, Mark. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to reverse the order. And I'm going to start with you, Attorney Murphy, and then Judge Beamer, and then Mark, you're going to be last.
Well, thank you for that, Todd. This has been a great show. I've enjoyed this, and I'm glad we got that audio thing worked out. Why should you vote for me? My name is Joseph Patrick Murphy. I'm running for judge. I want to bring a judicial temperament to the courtroom. I want people who go through that court process to understand what's going on. And that means taking time, being modest, controlling your emotions as a judge, and where possible, explaining things. When you leave court, you should know that whatever the result was, it was a result of a rational, reasonable, and fair process. That's the whole point of the court system. Civilization built courts and created judges to create fairness. And that's what you should get, and that's what you will get from me. There you go.
Well, thank you. Judge Beamer?
I would say, I believe it's a combination of experience, understanding the system, but also temperament and empathy. Very quick story that I'll explain why this matters so much to me and why I think being a judge is so important. When I was a prosecutor, I prosecuted a case where an 18-year-old girl was the subject of a home invasion, robbery, and physical and sexual assault, which was an incredibly horrible event. And I stayed in contact with her over the years. And when I became a private defense attorney, I took several of her criminal cases because she had become found herself in the throes of substance abuse because she had no family support. And she had no socioeconomic support to allow her to get the sort of treatment and therapy that she needed. So she ended up turning to self-medication. She ended up obtaining four cases in the short span of about 6 months, all for nonviolent offenses involving theft and possession of drugs. And I had a judge that did not consider her to be an individual, that looked at her like a score sheet. Here's her prior record score. Here's her offense gravity score. And he put her in jail for well over a year. And I watched her get progressively worse and worse when what she needed was understanding, substance abuse treatment, and probably some mental health treatment to deal with some of all of the issues in her background. And I had a judge that didn't consider any of that. And so I saw it from both sides. I saw what happened to her when I was a prosecuting attorney. And then I saw as I tried to help her as a defense attorney. And I said to myself, the day that she got sentenced, boy, if I ever had an opportunity to do it differently and to treat everybody like an individual, that's what I would do. And I feel believe that so very strongly and try to do that every day. And I'd ask anybody who's had someone who's been in front of me for the last year, ask them for their experiences as to whether or not that occurs each and every day in my courtroom. I really, truly believe it does. And I think it's why I would be honored to be one of the individuals that ends up being able to transform this bench in Allegheny County. Thanks so much for having us, Todd. This was a great forum.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. Mr. Daffner.
Thanks. As Joe and Bruce had said, you know, I think it boils down to experience. And experience doesn't just mean longevity of practice. We've all been practicing roughly for three decades. You know, my experience has taken me from here to Philadelphia, everywhere in between. So I have seen the best and the worst that all different courts have to offer. I know what works. I know what doesn't. But legal experience is not the only experience you need to excel as a jurist. I think you also have to have experience with people. And, you know, again, all the candidates you see today have dealt with, you know, thousands of clients, thousands of cases where you really know where people are coming from. You have to have your finger on that pulse to understand what's going to work in whatever particular situation is presented to the court. And, you know, it can't just be this academic thing like Socrates, his old saying was, four qualities make a judge, to hear soberly, to answer wisely, or what is it? To hear courteously, to answer wisely, to consider soberly, and to decide impartially. I think you also need to know about people. And Judge Della Vecchia used to say that too. I remember his, you know, when he was running, he says, you don't only have to know the law, you have to know about people. And if you know the law and you know about people, chances are you're going to be a good judge. Thanks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I am honored, you know, to call each and every one of you my friend. You know, we walk through such tumultuous times. You know, there's equity and of course, you know, there were bad decisions. And but I truly believe that, you know, all three of you would make, you know, excellent members of the bar, you know, and I hope that, you know, your respective, you know, candidacies are successful. And it's an honor, really. I mean, we've been doing this for 27, 30 years to see my friends finally, you know, progress to the stage where they're now becoming, you know, members of our bench. You know, so that's amazing. And you guys are doing such a great job. I can't thank you enough. And I mean this humbly and sincerely. I can't thank you enough for coming onto this show and sharing your platforms with our potential constituents, because, you know, they need to hear this from you. They need to be able to put a face with the message. And the fact that you guys were willing to share your platforms, and I know that you guys are so, so busy, but the fact that you're willing to do that means the world to me. So God bless you. I pray that you guys stay safe through all of this crazy pandemic stuff. I wish you tons of success going forward. My platform is your platform. So if there's anything that I can do to help disperse your message, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. And with that being said, you know, guys, each one of these gentlemen have social media platforms, and I'm certain that they would love to hear from you. I didn't ask you this question, guys, during the course of the interview, but if you wouldn't mind just telling people how they can find you, I'll start with you, Attorney Murphy.
Sure, you can visit the official campaign website. It's josephpatrickmurphy.com. It's all one word. You can also visit the Friends of Joseph Patrick Murphy Facebook page and the Friends of Joseph Patrick Murphy YouTube channel. That's for video hosting, see videos, talk about different topics, even some of the topics we discussed today. And I'll be happy to, you can read about the campaign, you can join a mailing list, or you can chat with us. josephpatrickmurphy.com.
Great. Judge Beamer.
Thanks, Todd. And I did want to say, Todd, that I think I told you this story once before. When I first started in the DA's office, one of the first things they had me do was come watch a juvenile adjudication hearing that you were doing up in the old building up in Oakland. And you were so thorough and so effective, I thought to myself, I don't know if I can do this trial law stuff, because I don't know if I can compare with some of these people. But it was just a great experience. But yeah, we have a campaign website. It's www.keepjudgebeamer.com. We're also at Keep Judge Beamer on Facebook and Instagram. So please feel free to check us out. Thanks.
Awesome. Awesome. Mr. Daffner.
Okay, my contact info is pretty easy too. It's daffnerforjudge.com for the website and Daffner for Judge on Facebook. So please look us up. And I have a Todd story to share too. The way I met Todd, Todd was a brand new public defender. This had to be in 1994 maybe, and I'd been practicing a year. And we had co-defendants. We were up in the old city court, which was the jail annex or whatever, the public safety building, you know, before it crumbled to the ground. And we had co-defendants. And the question was who fired a shotgun? And Todd and I are sitting there trying to, you know, figure something out. The judge, I believe it was actually Mackin, who was maybe less tolerant of both of us, you know, and, you know, meanwhile, the clients are standing behind us and they're pointing at each other. And it was just crazy, you know, and I met Todd and I'm not sure what Mackin did. I think he actually dismissed it. I met Todd, you know, so I note of all these fears.
The war stories, right? The war stories. Oh my gosh, the war stories. Well, listen, you just saw three great lawyers who have shared with you their experiences and their backgrounds and their vast, you know, trial advocacy skills, and they are asking for your help. And I'm asking you to consider them for the Court of Common Pleas positions here in Allegheny County. And with that being said, I want to thank you all for participating in my show. If you have any comments, please feel free to leave those for me on all my social media platforms. And if you like this show and you want to see others, please don't hesitate to hit like and to subscribe to my YouTube channel, because fighting for you is what I do.